Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I am hopping mad and I want something in the middle.
Aha!
Yep, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dad!
Monkey tennis?
Little piece my foot on his thigh.
With a chuckle.
Oh.
Monkey tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey tennis?
Okay.
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Monkey tennis?
Edmunds is a total wazzock of a guy.
Yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that?
This is great banter.
Yeah.
Monkey tennis?
Back of the net.
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the last in the current series of Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast, where for the last few weeks, we've been making our way through Alan's own podcast from the Oast House Series 3. And here we are at the thrilling climax with Episode 11, Wake, clocking in at 25 minutes 47. I'm joined, as ever, by Tom Dark.
Was it the ending I wanted? No. But was it the ending I needed? Again, no.
Nick Alder.
Sandwich makers, stop fucking us around.
And Tom Stab.
It was only the next day when I went to have a sad look at her knickers in the drawer that I realised her knickers had gone.
Oh, dear.
I knew I wasn't going to be able to get that one out.
I could barely follow that, but yeah, it's good stuff.
So, yes, episode 11, Wake, is the final episode in the series, clocking in at 25 minutes 47. Tom, what does Audible say about this one?
Our official episode synopsis for this one is, Alan shares his tips for correct sandwich making as Lynn grieves a dead friend. That's it. Nothing more.
I do enjoy how they focus on the trivial detail over the real meat of
yeah,
the episode.
The meat.
Yeah.
So, massively yes. So, yeah. And actually, speaking of the meat of the episode, I think at this point, it's going to be sensible to get producer Jed to drop in the spoiler klaxon now, so we are about to enter a spoilerific zone. Jed, drop the klaxon.
Rude alert, rude alert. An electrical fire has knocked out my voice recognition unicycle. Many Wurlitzers are missing from my database. Abandoned shop. This is not a daffodil. Repeat, this is not a daffodil.
So, bread scoop, spread boom. Discuss.
I did like the sound of cheap white bread. I don't know what everyone else thinks, but I have a real, real soft spot for the cheapest of white bread. I would draw the line at stalk margarine. You know, I think I have got form with enjoying the tinned meats that Alan has talked about. Cheap white bread I like, but stalk margarine is a hard no.
So goblin meat pies, yes. Stalk margarine, no.
I think there's a lot in this opening section to upset Tom Stab, but namely that Alan is buttering slice after slice. So he's buttering both sides.
Well, he's not buttering anything.
Well, that's true. He's marging. He's marging.
He's stalking.
What I will say on Nick's point about the cheap white bread, I think it's one of those things that very much has a time and a place. And I would say a bacon sandwich that is perfect for cheap white bread. I think that is,
and ham and
the
mustard. Ham and mustard.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah.
A sausage sandwich as well. I think you've got meaty goodness in the middle, particularly if you've got that sort of white bread where if you kind of like the sausage basically like leaves like. Fingerprints, sausage prints in the bread. It's perfect.
You want it to look like it's been in a sandwich toaster without putting it in a sandwich toaster. It needs to have that waffle effect.
I don't really have. There's no kind of like response required to this. But the amount of times that Alan references stalk margarine and says the word stalk margarine in this episode is ludicrous and totally unnecessary.
Actually, I wonder, is Stalks still a going concern? Is it like still an available brand?
Yeah, I did Google.
Okay, because in my mind, it's like a very 80s right thing. Right, okay.
I mean, it's primarily for baking. It's for, you know, it's for making pastry and stuff at this point. I wouldn't be having it in place of butter, but each to his own. I feel like we've got very meta here in that I was watching this episode, listening to this episode, desperate to get to Michael. Probably we've got Monkey Tennis listeners desperate for us to get into it. But here we are talking about what goes in a white bread sandwich.
that's what this podcast is all about, surely. That's all good.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely something that warrants discussion and debate. I feel like Mr. Kipling gets an absolute trashing here, and it is unjust. And, you know, are they exceedingly good? Well, that's up for debate. But no. They are definitely good. I think they are good.
I mean, I quite like that because he goes, exceedingly good cakes? Like, as if he's coming up with that phrase and it hasn't been the Mr. Kipling slogan for nigh on 30 years.
And the rest,
Doesn't he describe, because he's catering a wake in Lynn's kitchen, doesn't he describe it as looking like the reward in paradise for Mr. Kipling jihadi?
Yeah, and we should probably say that this is for Moira, who has sadly passed, and it's her wake. And that I did enjoy this. Moira has basically died of high cholesterol due to lots of lasagna and custard, which as a diet will probably do it for you. Although you can't blame her. Lasagna and custard, two of the best things that you could possibly eat.
I had both over Easter weekend and thoroughly enjoyed them both. Thankfully...
Not together.
I don't have as sedentary a lifestyle as Moira, and I am half her age, so I'm not worried yet.
Yeah, but at some point those will intersect and and then you're doomed. So the scene setting here is that the catering for the wake with cardigan clad women and cheap cakes, and Alan says the nosh at a wake has to be the bleakest meal one can imagine. And I think he's kind of onto something there. It's very traditional, the tiny kind of sandwich platters and cold sausage roll type of thing. It's feels like quite a uniquely kind of British tradition of quite crap, generally quite bland food at kind of big social gatherings of this nature.
So I think the thing with funeral food and wake food is that obviously you've got a lot of people to cater for, so it often tends to be quite cheaply made. But do you think there's also something in the subconscious that the planner doesn't want to like go too deluxe because it feels too much like throwing a party? Like... the food has to be sort of death appropriate, therefore not too lavish, not too decadent. I don't know. That's my theory.
I mean, I would absolutely go to town on this kind of food at like a buffet, at a whatever kind of social gathering it is. These sandwiches, they sound great. Sausage rolls, great. Massive bowl of Wotsits, yes please. Yeah. I'm in.
Yeah. It's what he/she/they would have wanted. doesn't he describe Lynn and Moira as Starkey and Crutch?
Yes.
They describe themselves as Starsky and Hutch, but Alan describes them as Starkey and Crutch.
Crutch.
Because Moira Lynn's because she has wing. A crutch, and Lynn because she shares the views of, was it Professor David Starkey? Apparently the only gay that she likes.
That's right, yeah. And so, Lynn hasn't taken Moira's death well, but she is prone to moroseness. And it's the return of Flexigrief. There's a Flexigrief reference back to Iron Man and Partridge, where she had 36 hours off for her mother's death.
Yeah. My assumption here is they've almost rerun that gag in the assumption that there's going to be a large chunk of people that maybe haven't gone to that book. And so they've almost kind of got a second life out of that joke, because they kind of replay it again as if it's sort of new. I know he obviously harks back to he gave it to Lynn before, but I wondered if some of that was like, oh God, let's just do Flexigrief again because it is funny and not everyone's going to know it, maybe.
I don't know. There is one of those things as well. It's kind of just consolidating the world, the APU. So I guess when it was first mentioned in the book, you get a more detailed breakdown of how the Flexigrief system worked, but this is a bit more of a passing reference.
Yeah, it can be both.
Yeah, I was also going to say, I thought this line was brilliant that comes just before the Flexigrief thing. Alan talking about Lynn and Moira saying, they are no longer friends. Moira passed away last week, effectively ending the friendship. I thought that was very funny.
How callous of her. Yeah. I've noticed a growing impatience in my notes just after the cheap white bread bit. It's, but I'm really just waiting for an update on Michael, I can't lie. Then when Moira dies, I go, great, this does tie back to Michael at least. And then I've got, Lynn doesn't need time, she needs purpose. Could it be time to track down Michael? Then I've got a bit that's... it says something like, Seldom is his ex-dog. He did try to replace Seldom, but had it escorted from the premises. And then finally, I'll put Michael reference. Come on! Exclamation mark.
There are some fun bits referring to Lynn before we get into Michael more in this episode, though. That Alan has been sending her on missions to find, gyroscopular screws? Which is a purely fictional product just to keep Lynn busy.
Yes,
as a duty of care,
I need to busy her. So he sent her to B&Q to find something that doesn't exist.
He also says 10% of her time is spent on huffing and puffing, which I quite liked.
I also really enjoyed this line where Alan says, Moira's passing is doubly sad because as she went cold, so did the trail in the pursuit of my friend Michael.
That's very much like the like when he's talking about the end of his career dying at the end of Know Me, Knowing You.
Yeah,
but of course, a man did die.
Yes. Yeah, perfect. Yeah.
So Moira had called the resort in Portugal, but Michael doesn't work there anymore. And she died writing Michael's UK number down, which I thought was a little bit too close to Chris Feather's death in Iron Man and Partridge. Somebody dying as they're writing something that's pivotal for Alan. Like, that's too much of a coincidence to do that twice, I think.
They've also had the text from a book transposed onto Alan's face when he's fallen asleep as well. So there's a little bit of repetition going on here. I can forgive the Chris Feather thing, but you're quite right.
This number obviously goes through several mutations between now and the end of the episode. Did we all try calling all the different versions? I know
yep.
I did.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's good to confirm that it is the area code for Reading, so the kind of facts do hold up. But yeah, this number, the first number, 0118-011-1510, yeah, it doesn't actually work at all.
They're all one-digit short, aren't they, of actual phone numbers? That's why.
I think
it ends up being a full phone number.
They're too short.
Right, okay.
It's one digit too short, so it's never going to work.
Did everybody clock the idea that the number would be backwards because of the cheek before?
No, I didn't.
I did have a guess at that part.
No, I think particularly on first listen, I thought this was quite well done in terms of, in this episode, you get quite quickly to this like, oh, Moira made contact with the holiday resort and got a number for him. As like, well, we're going to get to some kind of Michael conclusion quite quickly. And I quite enjoyed the way that then there are several kind of hoops to jump through to actually get to the crescendo of the episode in terms of like the differing numbers and stuff. So I did quite enjoy that.
And this is the point where I really start playing with listeners' expectations as well, because you have like this meta conversation where Alan's saying to Lynn, you don't always get the ending you want. And it feels very much like the writer's teeing us up, teeing us up to say Michael's not coming, effectively. You're not coming, are you, Michael? There's also a nice bit of wordplay in the episode titles in that the last episode was Dreams and this is Wake, but it's awake. not just waking up.
On that point around not always getting the ending you want, I thought there was a bit of a twist around the kind of the Carol narrative with him kind of running off with Carol, having a big snog at the end. the way he has usually talks about Carol is in reasonably derogatory terms, but this almost suggested that at a certain point in his life, maybe he still had feelings for Carol. Or maybe this is just a fictitious scenario that was nothing more than that. But this is the first time Carol's been portrayed in a somewhat positive light.
I think it also is part of effectively a Partridge greatest hits run here, where you've got him being mean to Lynn again. You've got Carol, you've got Michael, then he's onto the BBC as well. Like, suddenly it's ticking all the all the I'm Alan Partridge boxes.
And also we find out a little insight about Carol coming back to the family home, which we've not really heard before. So it sounds like Alan was in, but didn't hear Carol coming back because he was watching Smokey and the Bandit on full blast. And I think as Tom said in his opening quote at the beginning, he only realised that she'd gone when he went to go and look at her knickers. Was it to have a look at her knickers when he was sad, or have a sad look
at her knickers?
Yeah. And there was only one left, but they were, which he tried to rip in two, but they were too strong. They were strong knickers, so he's just used it for a rag to check the oil in the car.
I think I kind of made some notes here, kind of what we've been talking about, this kind of almost like a Partridge throwback greatest hits thing. And I think, you know, we've talked a lot about how the character has evolved and changed over the years, and some people sometimes kind of criticise that because effectively Alan and Coogan are merging into Bond. But I think on the whole, we've always said we like the version of Alan that we're getting in this more modern day era and in the Gibbons era. And I think at least what the Gibbons are very good at doing, they make an effort to link current Partridge back to the original 90s Partridge kind of narrative tropes. I think there are always throwback connections in all their newer projects. So yeah, there's always an effort to link new Partridge to like the most famous and quoted Partridge projects that people perhaps know better, which I think is a wise thing to do. And sometimes that's just in kind of like the use of specific words or linguistics, or sometimes it is going back to like a story about Carol or him at the BBC or something. So I do think it works. I don't think it's kind of just for the sake of it. I think it helps tie everything together in quite a kind of legitimate way for me.
What about Lynn's big climax?
What about it, Tom?
It's just the kind of like noise that he makes that I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
Did everyone have a list of why Moira's send off is very much in the budget end of the funeral market?
Well, she got a rubbish pension and didn't buy a second home in the 90s, which is probably
something
we all should have done, but sadly weren't able to because even we were quite young in the 90s. She's having basically cheap sandwiches instead of a lovely M&S platter of sandwiches, which is obviously the ideal if you're having a wake. At the very least, you'd want an M&S platter, surely.
Is this the bit where he's sticking the boot into Boots as well? Which is complaining about how boot sandwiches are, the filling is all bunched in the middle, giving the illusion of a plump sandwich, but there's a barren tundra of unoccupied bread. I love that because that is true,
yep.
And Boots are the main culprit.
Correct.
Absolutely. Central packing is the crime here.
Yeah.
And Boots, I totally used to be a 100% Boots advocate, but I think I've fallen foul of central packing too much. And by the end of it, the crusts are bone dry and those prawns have been scrunched into the middle. And I'm not having it anymore, Adam. I'm not.
Suddenly, even the 500ml drink is simply not enough to quench that barren bread thirst.
Bit of sandwich chat here as well. He talks about cut the sandwich diagonally. Interested to get group consensus here. Can we all agree with me? Diagonally cut sandwiches just taste better.
Yes, and it feels like there's more of them. It's an optical illusion.
But I do have one exception to the rule here. I think sausage sandwiches, you have to cut straight down the middle because otherwise you get a tiny little slither in the very corner.
Yeah.
So those are the sandwich rules of which we can all agree.
Well, I would say I always cut mine in half, but I actually think that what you've said is right. So I'm going to change my ways.
I mean,
we're providing a service.
Whichever way you do it, you're cutting them in half.
I know what it is. I thought I was getting more. The way it was pitched to me, I was getting more sandwich.
Well, I mean, on a related note,
has anyone ever seen a dinner lady seasoned food? Because Alan certainly hasn't.
No,
I
love that
absolutely line.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
And have you ever used Tabasco at a wake? And have you ever seen a woman who looks like a permed samurai? As Alan described Julia.
Is it time to talk about Prince Philip being indestructible and like a geriatric Terminator?
Yes. It will be, yes. I just want to talk a bit about them. That we've talked a bit about Stuart Lee on the podcast before. At this point in the episode, I really felt like I was watching Stuart Lee do stand-up, desperate for a satisfying ending, brackets, Michael/punchline, but being made to learn that the agonising setup, brackets, long section about sandwich etiquette, is where the real humour lies.
Yeah.
I see what you mean with that. Also, actually, before we get to Prince Philip, when he's talking about this kind of, when you think he's perhaps setting up that we're not going to get the ending that we wanted, and how he talks about Audible, is it the ending Audible wanted? Absolutely not. They've been very vocal about that. They actually wanted me to lie and make a better ending. The bit I realised here is he said, if they wanted me to lie, they'd either have to kill me or up my fee. Yeah. I thought it was very, very true to the character there.
Yeah. this kind of Prince Philip section, I don't know what everyone else thought, but yeah, you can see the timer ticking down on the episode and it becomes apparent what is about to come. And I was kind of like, get through this. Just didn't really hear.
Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, because I mean, yeah, I didn't make a note of actually what time in the episode that we get to the Michael reveal, but it's very late in the day, isn't it?
Super short. I mean,
there's a couple of minutes left.
We're not far off by the time Prince Philip is invoked. And I guess we should basically just say that this comes about because Alan talks about being able to make generic speeches about people he doesn't really know. So this is in relation to kind of Moira, and he tells a story about essentially when he was at the Rackets Club and finds out that Prince Philip has died, and then had to stand up on the reception table at his Rackets Club and address the room and give a speech about Prince Philip, which
the Rackets fell silent that day.
Yeah.
I mean, is this effectively satire because people don't or didn't really care that much?
It's like, you know where you were when Prince Philip died. Yeah, no, you don't. No one knows.
Yeah. And also, crucially, that nobody cares now because we're all waiting to hear from Michael and we're having to sit through this long Prince Philip bit.
The other thing is that he describes Prince Philip as being indestructible. I mean, if you'd looked at him for the last 5 to 10 years, he looked basically like a wet biscuit ready to crumble at any point.
I like that someone started singing Candle in the Wind as well.
Yeah, that is presumably. That is quite funny.
Any royal association, why not sing Candle in the Wind?
And there is just a little bit of colour to this, is that it all happened during lockdown and obviously they weren't supposed to be there.
Yeah.
which he does keep saying as well.
It's another topic to discuss that we've seen in this time, which I'll be honest, this close to the end of the episode, I didn't expect to be touching on chemsex and Lynn in the same sentence. Yet here we are, and I feel like I should defend Lynn's honour quickly, because it wasn't Lynn involved in the chemsex party.
Thank God.
It was her, it was her nephew Tim, who was using her house while she was away. And whilst I think Alan suggests that you could simply fumigate it, I really enjoyed that Lynn insisted on calling the parish exorcist, who came down with a jerry can of holy water to presumably douse about the place.
Now, is the joke here that there isn't such thing as a parish exorcist?
surely
exorcists aren't actually like official members of the church. They are just like stooges and con men who come out and take advantage of people who think that exorcism is a thing.
You're probably right.
I expect so, yeah. And so we're briefly back to the buffet chat to segue us into the most important part of the episode. So there's chicken drumsticks out, which look like Andrew Marr in his shorts. And then Moira's name is backwards on the cake. I did pause the episode at this point to say, I predict that they're now going to figure out the thing that I figured out with Michael's number being backwards. So they do. And I've just got my notes. Yes, come on, a Birmingham number. Followed by Alan saying, why would you voluntarily go to Birmingham?
That's kind of a bit of a throwback to this time, I think, series one, where Alan's talking about the architectural wonder that is Spaghetti Junction. And he says something along the lines of, it really is amazing the lengths that people will go to avoid going into Birmingham.
Yeah. Love that the sandwich lady is the one that solved this as well.
Yes. Yeah. Really nice touch.
And yes, it's Michael on the line.
Hello.
If you do search that the Birmingham number as well, it's not a real number, but Google did actually bring up the closest search result is Birmingham Women's Hospital, which I thought was mildly concerning. You certainly don't want Michael anywhere near a women's hospital, do you?
He'll just smile at, he'll smile at them, even if they're not
exactly,
smiling back.
Even though exactly that.
How did we all feel when we heard Simon Greenall / Michael's voice?
Punched the air, basically. Brilliant.
I've just got, I'm so happy in all caps in my notes here. Let's talk briefly about the content of this call as well.
We will literally be talking briefly about the content of this call.
Yeah. I mean, it is short, but I also think there's like an important lesson in here for the listeners of our podcast, for the listeners of Alan's podcast, which is kind of the writers are almost saying like, you don't really want this. Like, you don't want a long conversation with Michael. Like, this is, they're sort of making fun of the fact that you've waited to hear this and it's very brief. But also, it's so kind of understated, that's what makes it funny. Like,
oh yeah,
the fact that Michael just sits straight back into it, and it's like, it's no big surprise that Alan's called him. Like, yeah. He's like, oh, it's Alan Sharples, no Partridge. Oh, no, Mr. Partridge, like that, and that, just straight back into it.
I think this is genius writing, and it really is like less is more. Ironically, on this podcast, less is more. But yeah, it's like, this is exactly all you need it to be. I think they got this pitch perfect.
It's just a very funny bit of content about the value of giving people or not giving people what they want.
You must have a million questions. What's a podcast?
Yeah, I mean, but it's so true to what the character would and should be, that he's totally nonplussed. So, you know, Alan has built this up over the years, this kind of potential search for Michael. So I can't believe I'm talking to you, and he's literally getting monosyllabic responses. Which I think is the right thing. They could have gone a bit OTT and made this like a full-on two-way conversation, but I think it's perfect that on the whole you just have Michael saying "I" and "hello" and stuff like that. I think that's exactly, this is everything I wanted it to be, basically. And almost to break this down, it's just like the best way to almost dissect this is to literally just recite it line for line, because I think it's just so bang on.
Yeah, and it's a series of like couplets where basically Alan's making it out to be a big deal, you know, partly because it is, but also because he's trying to make podcast gold out of this, and everything he says is punctured by Michael not caring. So it's like, it's Alan Sharples, you know, and then like, he talks about the podcast, what's a podcast, and he's like, how are you? He's like, I'm just eating some toast.
Yeah, like, and it's like, you didn't know. Drown then? He's like, me? No, are you all right? Yeah. It's such a big deal for Alan, but it's just nothing for Michael, which is also hilarious because, and again, I think true to the Michael character, I mean, how many years since he's spoken to Alan, let alone see him? Like, I can't think now off the top of my head what year Alpha Papa would have been, but you know, this is what,
2013, I think. 2012. I mean, yeah,
it's 10 years, give or take a bit more, a bit less. So yeah, and it's like, for Alan this is huge, and for Michael it's like, oh, hi.
He hasn't thought about Alan at all in those 10 years, has he?
No.
And doesn't it paint Michael as the sort of person who very much has people wafting in and out of his life that mean a lot at the time and then are forgotten as soon as he's, you know, like, he feels like a very sort of transient guy, doesn't he? Sort of, you know, he's living in a bedsit, then he's in Portugal, now he's, you know, back in, now he's in Birmingham, next thing you know he's jumping off a pier, he works as a security guard, now he's, you know, like, he's just sort of, he's an odd job man, and he's like, he'll live wherever the wind blows him, and he'll be friends with whoever's around at the time, you know?
Mm.
And he will, yeah. And he will keep your digger if you're not gonna.
I love that. That's so sinister. That there's just a man in the back with the dogs, whose digger he's kind of keeping hold of. Like, no detail. Like, just a very short insight as to what's going on in Michael's life at that time. And
it's deeply sinister.
We've also glossed over one of the highlights, which is Alan saying that he's with two women, and Michael's immediate response is, yeah, you dirty shit, save an ugly one for me. I mean, save an also, ugly one for me.
Let's break down the rationale behind Michael's dilemma here as well. So Michael's dug a hole, but the man hasn't paid him, so Michael's locked the man in his digger until he pays. To which my question is, how is this going to resolve itself? How does he expect the man locked in his digger to get money? It's not going to happen, is it?
Unless if Michael's got a card reader and he can take Apple Pay.
I mean, more likely that the guy is going to activate the digger and attack Michael. But, yeah, I think that's for another series. Do we think if there's another Oast House that Michael will feature more regularly than he does in this?
I hope not.
Oh, it's interesting because, I mean, yeah, it really makes you wonder what they're going to do with this next. So now they've opened the gate to Michael being back in the APU. I think the best thing they can do is use it really sparingly, which, you know, as we said, like, you know, they've gradually made Lynn a bigger part of this over three series. So, you know, what you don't want, I think, is like suddenly every episode is like the Alan and Michael show, because I think the less is more approach really works as they've shown here. But yeah, it's interesting because the potential is Michael can become a recurring figure again. And it's even like he could even appear in And Did These Feet, for example, because in terms of the chronology, like we're up to that point where that could happen. But yeah, it's again like giving people what they want. Is it really what they want? Is it really what we should get? I think, yeah, I don't really know what they'll do with it, but I feel like I just hope that they do it sparingly so it still has like impact and is still really funny. I think what's also quite good about this is we don't really learn much about Michael, what he's been doing, where he's been for the last 10 years. And I think to my mind, his scenario hasn't really changed from the Michael of I'm Alan Partridge in terms of, you know, when he's living in that house with like the biker and a spoon in the bathroom and no door on the toilet or whatever, all that sort of stuff, like this kind of weird drifter existence where you've got a man locked up in his digger. So the only thing we actually learn is that he's got to eat Olivio shite because his cholesterol is through the roof. That's the only new Michael intel we really get, that and the fact he's living in Birmingham.
So hopefully more to explore, or perhaps we leave it there and the mystery, just let the mystery do what it does.
I think it would just be, I'd just like to put something out. It would be very interesting to hear what our listeners thought when Michael made his return, their thoughts, their feelings, their emotions. I'd be quite keen to hear what people thought. And again, on the point of should Michael be used sparingly, would they like to see him back full time? I think for the next series, we should cover people's feedback, but it'd be interesting to know what our listeners thought when the spectre of Michael finally made himself known.
Yeah, I'm very keen to know how satisfied people were with the ending they got, and also whether anybody feels like they were taught an important lesson about what to expect and having your expectations dashed or met.
So actually, like, you know, because I've said I thought this is pitched perfectly. Does everybody else feel like that, or does anybody feel like this didn't work?
No, I agree with you, Tom. I think this was the perfect way to bring Michael in. It was subtle, it was funny, and I think the kind of slight anticlimactic nature of it makes it funny. It like, if they suddenly went off, there was another episode where they had a whole episode together going on an adventure, I'm sure it'd be very, very good and very, very funny. But I think, yeah, the way they've done it in this episode is bang on.
Yeah, it's a real tightrope, isn't it? Give people any less and it doesn't justify the build-up. Give people any more and you'll sort of oversaturate.
I was going to say, for the Michael, aka Simon Greenall fans amongst the listenership as well, if you haven't listened to it, we did interview Simon very early on in the podcast. So if you go back to episode 39 of Monkey Tennis, which was many years ago now, we did a fantastic live interview with him where he gave us some great insight into the I'm Alan Partridge recording process and also some actually unaired Michael interaction, which was brilliant stuff as well.
I would say, even if you're not a fan of Simon Greenall, but you're particularly interested in Napoleon, you probably get a kick out of that episode as well.
Oh, yes, and that.
One more thing from this episode. I enjoyed that it's Lynn delivering the credits this time around, although it very quickly goes out of Lynn's voice and becomes Felicity Montague reading it out. But it starts as Lynn, which I did enjoy.
Do you remember, I feel like, I don't remember how many series ago now, but I think we did discuss essentially a Searching for Michael podcast vehicle Alan as kind of a Predictor Partridge type
thing. The Search for Michael.
Yeah, so we kind of got that right in a way, because that has been the narrative thrust throughout this. So I'm going to give us a tick for that one. So years down the line, we got it right.
Or the idea was wholesale nicked by the writers and creators of Alan Partridge. You decide. I'm not one to say.
And they're welcome to it. It's fine.
Yeah, I'm sure we have a case against them for benefiting from someone else's output.
But then they'll hear a recording and they'll hear someone discussing the new colour of the Range Rover in the background, and then they'll suddenly have us bang to rights.
So I believe that's it for this episode of the series, unless anyone has anything else. Let's talk about how we feel about Oast House Series 3 as a whole.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm happy to start with my thoughts. I'm going to start with, I don't know if it's going to be a controversial opinion, but I think this is comfortably the weakest series of Oast House. I did enjoy the overall narrative through line of The Search for Michael. I'm going to compare Alan Partridge to something I don't think it's been compared to before, but Game of Thrones. And when reading the Game of Thrones books, basically you would have a chapter dedicated to a character each time. So every chapter heading was the character's name. So you would have this whole section, this whole chapter where you'd read about this character, and then it would end probably usually on some sort of cliffhanger. And you just want to get straight into the next thing about this particular character, but then it would jump to another character and you go, oh, for fuck, I'm going to have to wait another 200 pages to find out how this pans out. So that, I always found that a little bit frustrating. I did find this a little bit frustrating in a similar vein, because I don't think the episodes that fill in, that are the filler between the Michael relevant episodes, are particularly strong compared to previous Oast House series. So while I would say I did still enjoy this series, I would say it's comfortably the weakest, where I would put series 1 and 2 at a sort of 9 out of 10. I would consider this to be maybe a 6.5, 7. There is some really good stuff in it. Of course there is. It's the Gibbons. It's Steve Coogan. There's always going to be some absolute gold in there. But I would say, overall, it's not as consistently strong as the previous two series of Oast House.
But Alan promised us it wasn't demonstrably weaker.
Unfortunately, in my opinion, I did enjoy this one slightly less. But again, I'm not saying it's terrible. I'm just saying compared to the other two, I think it is weaker, and I'm pitching it at a 7 out of 10 compared to the other two episodes, the other two series, which were a comfortable 9 out of 10. And I think it is just because the Michael stuff is great and it delivers, but the stuff that is the filler between those episodes is just not as strong as or consistently strong as previous series have been.
I'm happy to go next. I mean, I think I do disagree. I felt for me this was one of the stronger series of Oast House, and I do agree that the quality, the range of quality is very up and down, and I do think there is quite a lot of filler, but I think when it's good, it's very good. And I think we've talked about this before, but I am a real sucker in Partridge and in comedy of there being a narrative arc. I need a bit of heart and a bit of story behind it, and I think this delivered that much more than, you know, there's been previous almost whole series of Oast House that could have been delivered in any order. And I think I remember saying, you know, relating this to Peep Show, there was one series of Peep Show that was filmed so that the episodes could be put out in any order. And as soon as I heard that, I thought, well, this isn't the series for me, because it's not going to, nothing would have changed by the end of it from the start of it. And I think, so I really enjoyed Michael. I really thought the way they teased Michael was fun. And I quite liked being, like, as a listener, being played with a bit, you know, in terms of, they're almost setting up that you're not going to hear from him, and then you do hear from him, but it's just a tiny bit, but it's enough, but it's also funny in how little of it there is. So I thought that was really great. I think this is a good line. I think they are starting to recycle more material, and that's good and bad. I think so, you hear a lot of jokes that you've heard in similar forms before, but you also are getting more callbacks to classic, let's say, peak 90s, early noughties Partridge, which I think I said this on a previous episode, they're a bit more comfortable about giving the fans what they want to an extent, and also toying with the idea of giving the fans what they want, which is why they've done such a good job of bringing Michael back. So I really enjoyed this series. I think probably more than the second, maybe even more than the first, but a large part of that is down to the Michael, the push and pull of Michael.
I think just to go back on my feeling that this is slightly weaker, I think, again, this is my personal opinion, I've become slightly fatigued with the Oast House podcast format. I think the first series, there was so much goodwill because it was new and we were like, this is amazing, it's so, so great. And then the second series was, again, I thought really, really strong. I think maybe I've just become a little bit tired of the format, and I personally hope this is the last series of Oast House that we get. For a while, maybe, like, because they've come out pretty regularly, but ultimately, if yeah, Tom just made the money symbol with his fingers. If Audible decide to dump
to drench them in cash,
to drench them in more cash, then there's going to be more. But again, the more there are, I feel like the quality may continue to dip slightly, because they're kind of forced into this corner of doing these because they're getting paid very, very handsomely for it. I think maybe I've
all
become
all the money.
All
comes.
The money comes. I think I've just become a little bit fatigued with the format. But yeah, just wanted to add that.
I think I'm happy to jump in next, following that, because I think that is the big question looming here. Is there anywhere else for Oast House to go after this? Really? Because there definitely is a bit of repetition going on now in terms of how some of the episodes work, but. Yeah, it's really interesting though, because I think, Tom, I think where you are is on the other end of the spectrum to where I am with it, and I think a lot closer to where Adam is. For me, I thought this might be the best series yet. I think I much prefer it as a 11 episode series.
Oh, so definitely.
Same
oh,
as
yeah.
series two.
Yeah, of course.
Like, it's much more, it's easier to consume and I think to enjoy instead of getting lost in, like, what was the first one, 20 plus episodes or whatever. So I think that really helps it. And yeah, I think for me, very much like Adam, having a narrative arc across the series that actually makes sense and has a payoff, I think was key. And I think, yeah, there was a narrative arc kind of across series one, but it just didn't actually really have any value.
The payoff with High Noon was not good. Yeah, but I think everything leading up to it was great. But yeah,
that was disappointing. So, you know, I think 11 episodes, a narrative arc that makes sense, has a proper payoff, I think are the things that really kind of puts this on top for me. I really enjoyed series two. I thought it was great and a lot of fun, but it was a bit more like it's Alan's activity of the week. Every week was quite a kind of standalone. Now I'm doing this. Now I'm going potholing, going wild swimming. For this series, for me, the only episode that felt like a real misstep was episode 10, Dreams. I literally could have done this whole series without that. But perhaps the contract with Audible was they had to deliver 11 episodes. I mean, it's funny as well, because initially, first listening to Coronation, I was a bit like, oh, I don't know if this is good. But the more I listened to it, the more I was like, actually, Alan back in commentary mode is great. Ultimately, I think I had lots of laugh out loud moments listening to this. There's a narrative that takes the APU forward. You've got solid cameos from Lynn and Michael. They've given fans what they want, but they've made us wait for it. And I think that's a good thing. You know, if they'd have introduced Michael in series one, or even Lynn's voice in series one, they'd have had like nowhere to go, really. I'd really be interested to know as well whether they always had this kind of story arc mapped out across the three series, or if it's just where they ended up going as they wrote. So yeah, that's where I'm with it. For me, it's top notch, I think.
Yeah, I would. I think I'm much closer to yourself, Tom, and Adam, in that I think it's my feelings are very, very positive, very warm towards it. I think series two and series three are great. I like series one. In fact, I think series one is also really, really good, but it is a little bit bloated. The payoff isn't so good. I won't repeat everything that's already been said, because I kind of agree with most of the things yourself and Adam have said. I don't know if this is necessarily a criticism, but I do feel that the writers are very familiar, and they kind of not make it look easy, but there's quite a lot of familiarities to the writing style, to the tone, to the construction of the jokes. And I think on the one hand, you can say that's because they're incredibly clever writers. They've made it look easy. You try writing an episode, it isn't easy. But at the same time, there are kind of tropes and things that are kind of reused and rehashed. Now, they're always funny, so I don't really mind that. But that's my only kind of like, I wouldn't quite call it a criticism, but like maybe critical observation, that the writing style, it is becoming a little bit familiar, even if the story and the narratives are constantly kind of mixed up.
So do you think there's an element of them kind of coasting a little bit, or just it becoming a bit too... I'm very hesitant to use the word lazy, because I don't think they are lazy writers at all. But like the beats and the tropes and how the jokes are set up and delivered are kind of becoming a little bit repetitive. But that's because that's how they've fallen into their writing style with Alan.
It's almost like they've invented the iPhone, and each and every iPhone is still a great phone and it's brilliant. And underneath it is really smart engineering. It's really clever. But the kind of the innovative leap from series two to three is limited. But where do you go when you've created the iPhone? Mm-hmm. That's
so
what I'm thinking.
I follow up to that, though, a two-parter for Nick. One, do you think there's too much Partridge now? And two, do you think it's time to expand the writing team and bring in some fresh blood?
Oh, God, I don't think so. I don't think change the writing team. Is there too much Alan? I don't think there is. Only in the sense that we're struggling to keep up with it now. that's the only thing. Well, what I would say is, I don't know how many people have read Big Beacon, but I think we might be having a slightly different conversation around Big Beacon. But I will keep that as a
wait,
tiny
so
chink of insight.
Are you saying that as somebody that has read it?
I have read Big Beacon.
When you say read, yeah. Do you mean
crucially
listened on Audible.
Yeah. The question about is there too much Alan, I would say, on the whole, no, because I think they always keep it fresh with different vehicles, different formats. However, I do think in terms of if you take all of the Oast House episodes, I think there are too many of those. I think there's probably, across the three series, you could probably lose maybe four or five episodes there, maybe even more. I mean, I was thinking about, it's almost like if you made a playlist of like the best episodes, you could have like an amazing 12 episodes together. Yeah. I mean, I can't quite decide what those would be, but I think, you know, you could really make it quite a concise kind of like with a bit of narrative in it, with Lynn in it, with Michael in it, you could lose any episodes you feel like a filler. I mean, I don't know, maybe that's an interesting thing. Perhaps, you know, if listeners get in touch,
What would be This Is the Oast House on Spotify, basically? Like, what would that playlist be?
This is from the Oast House. So, yeah. What's the ultimate there? 10, 11 or 12 episodes, what, somewhere between that, what would be the episodes you would choose? That's maybe an interesting discussion, maybe not, because it's also probably quite hard to keep track of actually what happens in which episode. Like, I don't know, but it's an interesting question.
Obviously, we would never get this information, but I'd be fascinated to know how this has done as a series. Obviously, it keeps getting, not me, I don't mean this series specifically, I mean Oast House in general, because obviously it keeps getting recommissioned, or it has, you know, it's obviously reached an audience in terms of, like, for them to keep paying them and keep them on the platform. But I guess the proof is there another series? Because if Audible want to deploy a truckload of cash to the Gibbons and Steve, they will. And it could be quite potentially hard to say no to. But it's whether the writing team and Steve still find the format and doing it creatively fulfilling.
It seems like they're in another run of enjoying Alan. You know, like they're not churning it out, because that implies the quality's dipped, but they are. There's a lot of it. There's you know, like you say, there's more than we can keep up with almost.
I would honestly say that I don't think it would do the character, and I don't mean this from a selfish point of view in terms of it would give us a chance to fucking catch up with what's been put out, but I feel like it wouldn't do the character any harm to go away for a couple of years. I'm not saying go away for another a huge, like, 10-year period or whatever, but obviously it's doing well because it keeps getting commissioned, and it's keep, you know, the character, the longevity of the character is not diminishing in any way, because if it was, they would stop commissioning books, the new TV series, Audible podcasts. I do, however, think it wouldn't do the character any harm to go away for a few years and then come back with something, and it would be very, very exciting, because remember how excited we were when this time came and when Oast House was announced. So a new format, there isn't really anything that he can do, really. Podcast, book, TV, film, maybe another film, I don't know. But I don't think he would do any...
I wouldn't be massively keen on that.
just something different. I just think obviously we don't know what the format and what the setup and Did These Feet is going to be like. Is it going to be traditional sitcom? Is it going to be travelogue? Is it going to be documentary? It could be a number of things. So we'll see. But I certainly wouldn't lose any sleep if Alan went away for a few years to come back and feel really exciting and fresh again. Not that it's not exciting, because the quality is good, but like just have that little extra something. I don't know.
I mean, it'd be interesting, what the kind of roadmap Steve and Rob and Neil have for the character, because I do think Did These Feet has been in the works for years and years.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, if that does all tie back to the whole driving ban thing, which we always reference, I mean, that was ages ago now. So, I think from the limited information we have about And Did These Feet at this point, that links to Alan coming back from Saudi Arabia. His trip in Saudi Arabia is referenced in Big Beacon. So it's kind of fascinating, like, how intertextual all these different projects are and these different, like, phases and eras. So I think, you know, in terms of from the Oast House, I think in Big Beacon, without getting into Big Beacon in great detail, I think, you know, him as a podcaster, that's kind of a reference point. But there's not any kind of like real, from what I remember, having listened only once so far, I don't think there's like a big narrative tie-in. Whereas I feel like the potential between the book and the TV series there is. So whether then there's a natural resting point after that TV series, perhaps, will kind of remain to be seen. But yeah, it's really interesting to think how much Partridge has happened since we started doing this podcast in, was it beginning of 2016?
Yep.
And I think, you know, there had been some quite significant gaps of Partridge existing before then. And pretty much since we started doing the podcast, it's barely bloody stopped. So I think it would do them some favours. I think like what you're saying really is because it builds up the excitement and the anticipation again more than anything.
So on the subject of there being some value in going away for a while and coming back fresh, this is the last episode in the current series of Monkey Tennis. I think it's probably apparent that we'll be tackling Alan's Big Beacon next, so to speak. So we'll be back later in the year. Unless these
feet starts airing like next week or something, which could happen based on our luck.
That's true.
We'll put this episode out and then they'll all come out.
Yeah,
that tends to be what happened, yeah. Isn't it? We prompt announcements by finishing recording and then they come up with something new. In the meantime, we would love to know what you think about this episode of Oast House and Alan in general and where he's going and your dreams for Alan's future. You can let us know on Instagram at @MuggyTennisPod, Twitter at @ThePartridgePod, Facebook.com/ThePartridgePod, email ThePartridgePod@gmail.com. If you want to throw some coins in the well, you've enjoyed listening to us and you want to support what we do, then it's ko-fi.com/muggytennis, and thanks in advance. So yes, I think that's it for now. We will also be covering Alan's recent appearance on Comic Relief as well in the next series. So yes, we'll let you know all about that when it's on its way. But for now, from all of us, thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate it. Thanks also to everyone that supported my charity appeal. Really, really appreciate those donations. And I'm sure Calm will as well. So thank you to everyone that donated this series. Until next time, from all of us at Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge Fan Podcast, thanks and goodbye.
He was a big, wide king.
I am hopping mad and I want something in the middle.
Aha!
Absolutely, yep, 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 absolutely.
Monkey Tennis?
Bring, bring. There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey Tennis?
Little pierce my foot on his thigh.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
Oh.
Monkey Tennis?
Radical, awesome, mega.
Monkey Tennis?
Okay.
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Monkey Tennis?
Edmunds is a total wazzock of a guy.
Yes, 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 and yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that?
This is great banter.
Yeah.
Monkey Tennis?
Back of the net.
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.